Welcome to Supercharge, the Change & Comms podcast. In this edition, we're heading over to the United States of America to chat with the changeologist and culture alchemist.
I'm Chris Bradley, and Pete and I are delighted to be with Douglas Flory today. Douglas is recognised as a top change management voice on LinkedIn and is on the Council of Advisors for the Association of Change Management Professionals. Douglas has spent his career working in change management, working across many sectors, and also leads change management training. I can't wait to find out more, but before then, as always, let's head over to Barcelona and say hi to Pete.
Hi, Chris. Thank you very much. Very topically, I was down at the port in Barcelona on Saturday looking at all the buildings going up for the America's Cup. So welcome, Douglas. It's great to have you. And we're really looking forward to grilling you with some questions to go over your wisdom today. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, of course. I'm excited to be here. And I'm looking forward to this time. Change management, that's my gig. That's what I love to do. That's my passion. Been doing it now for almost number of years, but it's been a long time. And I originally got started, like most people, not in change management. I actually got started in finance. And then they introduced me to project management and then Lean Six Sigma. And then eventually change management came my way. And I just have all these tools in my toolbox that I kind of blend together. And it's been a great journey ever since.
Since then, you've worked across a lot of different industries though, right? So I wondered if we could start by, could you tell us a bit about some of the standout moments and things that you've really enjoyed doing?
The best thing that I love about my job is the irony of it. It's managing change, right? And a lot of times people get scared or fearful when there's change or something like that, or there's the ambiguity of something. But I actually like it when something with change management and something new come together for the first time. I think that's exciting and captivating. Like one of my favorite phrases is change management and fill in the blank are great together because something like that. And I've had opportunities to explore things that I never would have considered before, like DE&I. Putting those two together, it just makes sense now that I think about it. But because there's some common tools and applications and encounters that will happen, but I never would have thought about that. Or we all went through the recent pivot to remote work. I never would have thought about, hey, change management should be leading that. Or, you know, lots of different areas with like legal or procurement, real estate. It's just been a very interesting combination. And that's really where I really enjoy it the most, is where we can do the traditional things we think of, like policy or technology, always focused on the people, of course. But being able to explore those new areas as change management matures, I think that's fun and interesting.
What was it? DE&I, did you say?
Here in the States, we call it DEI, and it's diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. And so they'll have groups, employee resource groups that are dedicated to various demographics to support them along the way.
Yeah, it's quite big. Yeah. It's big here too.
We just call it EDI. So. Why has that stood out for you though? Is it something to get involved with?
You know, I joined a company and during COVID era, and during that period, they hired a DEI leader. I reached out to her and I just wanted to welcome her and that kind of thing. And she started sharing some of the challenges she was facing. And as I was just listening to her and everything, I was like, wow, you know, that sounds familiar. And what I was hearing was like, stakeholder identification, resistance, champions, how do I get my message out there? How do I get buy-in? What's in it for me? All these different things that she was encountering. Because basically what she was doing was just going around the company and meeting various people to, you know, share their story and what she's going to be doing. And she got a lot of resistance, surprisingly, to her. And as I heard about those things, I was like, you know, I think I have some tools that could help you. And we've kind of started partnering together, and as we work together, it really helped her to accelerate and be better prepared and analyze and do what she needed to do successfully. And that's not something that, I don't know, I just, for some reason at that time, I never considered, well, this should go together. This just makes sense.
We've had a very similar conversation where I work at the moment. So, and we have a change management office, and we have the equivalent of what you're saying in terms of disability, equality, and so on. And they're two separate columns. And we could work together, and we can do. We do talk to each other. But I haven't seen the two put together as a kind of package.
I guess here's how I think about it. I think about DE&I and people. Ultimately, it's about people, right? And that's number one. Number two is, as you're trying to embed this into the culture of an organization, that's change. And so you have to be able to understand the culture, and you have to be able to understand how to get people on board. And otherwise, you're not going to have success if the employees don't identify or get involved with the program that you're creating for them. And so I view that as another lens on change management. And it's not that DEI and change management have to be in the same office. You could consult or partner with them and maybe do some coaching on the side, something like that. And that's kind of the model we followed. We didn't have like the same office. We had two separate centers of excellence for that. But, you know, you could always partner together because ultimately you're both trying to achieve the same thing for the company and for the employees. So it's always focused on the people. So why not figure it out?
No, well, it's actually quite interesting because in the background, I've just remembered that where I'm working at the moment, we have a quality impact assessment and we're about to roll out some significant training for the new supercomputer that's going to go across the organization. And within the organization, there's a whole different roles, a set of roles of people who either work in, you know, the markets or, you know, business sector or, you know, deep science. And actually the, you know, the diversity of the audience internally is almost like four or five different types of businesses all coming together from a very research heavy focus piece to commercial arm, right? Through to the financials or, you know, the meteorologists who are science focused and then a very data driven aspect as well. And actually, when you think about that quality impact assessment in terms of at least L&D, learning and development, it's actually really applicable to put that right up front to make sure that the materials, that interventions we want to land, well, as you described it, Douglas, you know, people can identify with it and say, actually, yeah, I can tune into that. That's appealing to my, you know, my personal neuro-linguistic needs or, you know, my ability to be able to just read something on screen right through from either end of the scale there. So it just reminded me of the same process just to go and ask for a copy of it before we actually branch into design mode. So I was in the background quickly saying, yep, got my mate here, Douglas. He's tipped me off to remind myself about the quality impact assessment. So yeah, good stuff.
You're rolling out a supercomputer?
Yeah.
I forgot to look. Where do you work?
I'm working at the Met Office in the UK, and we're partnered strategically with Microsoft, and we're building, or Microsoft are building with the Met Office team, a new supercomputer that will be in the cloud. So today, our supercomputers have all been on-premise, but for the first time, they're going to be on the cloud. And the first upgrade is almost a like-for-like, slightly bigger, and future upgrades will take us to many, many times the current size, which obviously improves the quality of science that gets pulled through into the products and services that either government, business, and commercial arms need to, you know, make decisions,
that's cool.
Save lives and thrive, essentially. That's the saying.
That computer, that supercomputer could be the greatest thing in the world, but if people don't know how to use it, it's just going to sit there and gather dust, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the exploitation of these things that really do drive the benefit, because otherwise, like you say, it's a set of servers, set of racks stuck in a secure location, wearing away. But if we don't pull the benefit out of them and you know, essentially help people thrive and survive, then what's the point?
I hope that my sleuthing on your LinkedIn profile is being correct, and you advertise your services as an independent consultant. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'll do that.
What's your okay? What's your kind of career journey been? You know, how have you ended up as a consultant, and what are some of the advantages or disadvantages of, you know, framing your services in that way?
Yeah. So when I started quite some time ago, you know, I was totally new to the whole industry and to the concept of change management. So I was exploring LinkedIn and like, how many people are out there and what's this look like? And, you know, kind of had the honeymoon glasses on a little bit. And so as I learned that there were so many more people out there and around the world, I thought to myself, wow, what's going to differentiate me from all of these people? What can I do to become the best that I can be as a change leader? And My professional journey has been that I've either been an employee and I've led change, or I've had opportunities to work in consulting firms and led change. And so as I bounce between those two sides of the table there, if you will, I kind of wondered, I was always thinking, I wonder what they're doing on the other side of the table, or why are they asking that question? What are they thinking? And I wanted to understand both sides of the table. And that's when I realized, I think that's what can make me perhaps differentiate myself and help allow me to be the best. Because when you have those conversations, whether you're consulting with a client or a company, or whether you're talking with the consultant, or whether you're the employee partnering with that consultant, you understand all dimensions as you go through it. And I think that that's ultimately how I've gotten here. So I've looked at it more as not necessarily a binary choice of A or B, but more about which one's the most unique opportunity and where can I go? And how can I help bring the best value and lead change successfully for a great experience for everyone? That's how I've gotten to where I am today.
Do you find people respond to you differently than you were when you were an employee?
Yeah. it they do positively and constructively. A lot of times they're like, well, you know, there's the binary question of why would you want to change to become an employee if I apply for a job as an employer? And so I have to explain that same situation I just did with you. But then on the converse, it gives me a lot of advantages and pros because people are like, oh man, I'm working with this consulting firm and I don't understand what's going on. And we're completely new to change. And, you know, the whole thing that a lot of people experience these days, all of a sudden my trusted advisor is able to come out and be able to partner with them and explain, here's what's happening. Here's why they're asking that question. Here's what that means, or here's their vision, that kind of thing. So it's got its moments, but I think typically it's for the best, is how I'd say.
Do you just wish you could get stuck in and do things sometimes, though? Or is it kind of more hands-off?
I don't care if I'm an employee. I don't care if I'm consulting. I just want to help you lead change. And that's truly what my passion is and what I love to do. So that's, I think that's part, getting back to one of your original questions, that's how I've had the opportunity to experience so many different verticals, so many different industries, so many different ways of implementing change, you know, whether it's culture or systems or people or business or what have you. Being able to do put those things together, I think that's been able to experience those things.
Have you had a situation, Douglas, where you've had to do all of those in the same kind of project or program, where you're looking at both technology, culture, business kind of, yeah, business change, and you're looking across and there's kind of like this overwhelming tide of people looking at you, go, well, what are you going to do then?
Yeah, actually, I had an experience recently where I was working with a client. I was consulting in this instance, and, you know, they were looking to update their systems. Now, I say update, I need to give you some context. This is a company that has been in business for over 100 years. A lot of heritage, a lot of legacy, a lot of, you know, this is the way we've always done it. But at the same time, we want to refresh. We want to be new. We want to be, you know, current with the millennials and the new generations. But we also want to really value and emphasize our historical wins, our legacy, how we got here. So how do you do all those things together? And that was one of the more interesting opportunities I had, because how often do you have a chance to kind of refresh a 100-year-old entity that has been involved in so many different things? So I found that really interesting and definitely got into the culture, the mindsets, the behaviors, some of the values and things like that. But it was a lot of fun. It was one of those things, again, where I was like, wow, how do you refresh a 100-year-old company and make it new? That's So not something you encounter every day.
I think you should do a podcast on that, Douglas, because I'd listen. That definitely sounds like a learning opportunity to me.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. But I mean, that's one of the things I love about this job, right? Is exploring that ambiguity, that new ground, and kind of breaking the mold as I think our industry and profession is at a maturation point, and we're growing and expanding, and I think we're evolving into new areas.
Something I wanted to talk about, and I was thinking, I don't know, maybe we can merge it together, but was a kind of top three tips type of thing. And I was originally thinking, what would your top three tips be if someone was setting up a change management office, or they were just bringing in that kind of change capability to their organization? But I'm wondering if we expand it slightly as well to just tips that you would give to lead change as well, because I think they do go together in terms of building that capability. This was inspired, by the way, by your post on the Lego Change Management Office, which I loved.
That was a lot of fun. I was surprised at the response, but people love Legos, and I'm one of them. So I have children, and over the Christmas break recently, they took all their Legos and merged them into like one giant universe of something. I don't know. It's like a hodgepodge of like jazz club, Harry Potter, you know, all the different things. And they've got this big, huge world they created up there.
Love it.
Sorry to diverge.
Say tips.
The interesting thing about that Lego post was that I think what it does is it actually creates some fun around it, but it also creates a vision, right, about how to create a center of excellence. And it kind of got a really strong reaction to, yeah, I really like this, or I really want this, right? And I think a lot of times when people think of center of excellence, they're trying to understand, like, you know, there's always that question, where does change management fit? Is it in HR? Is it in IT, or where is it? And I think we should have like a strategy office at an organization. And that strategy office should be a blend of different methodologies and skills together so that we can ultimately achieve whatever the company's objectives are. and steer and navigate those unexpected and the expected things. So when you're setting it up, number one, you got to have a vision. Number two, if you're going to have a vision, then you got to have a charter. You know, why are we here? What's our purpose? Who we serve? Those kind of fundamentals. Because what I found through experience when I've set up centers of excellence is that oftentimes, you know, there's a company that has thousands of employees, maybe, you know, all over the world, globally spread out. And there's typically like maybe 2 to 6 of you or something. How do you 2 to 6 people manage change across thousands of people across the entire globe? You know, the numbers and the math don't always work out too well there. So you have to be able to figure out a strategy and a structure and a plan to be able to have an intake process to educate them and teach them on these concepts, but also be involved at the right levels. So I guess that's tip number 2. And tip number 3 is draw upon the people side of change. That is, I know that sounds stereotypical or commonly said all the time in change management, but more than ever, I believe that skill sets and leadership need more focus on the people side of change. The power skills, if you will, that are often historically called the soft skills. I think we're at an evolutionary point right now where those type of skills and that focus and those talents are really what's going to accelerate organizations and people forward into the future, even today.
I like those. I do like those. And it kind of drives me back into something Pete and I have talked a lot about over the last couple of years, is that the combination of the skills needed to be a product owner, combining that with change management, actually really does start to evolve the thinking on how we deliver that cluster of changes, not just people, technology, or process or culture, but bringing them together. If you start off with your vision as you would a product, and you work your way down through your stories, which is your charter, and then you build your way through into your approach, your cadences, and your mechanisms, it's a really good starting point of 3 tips, I think. It was
something I'm just reflecting on. I found this for your second point in terms of capacity management and how do you actually prioritize and so on. It's everywhere I've worked so far, I've always tried to get to the point of having a service offering for, like, you know, your platinum, your gold, and your silver standard that you give out to people. Chris, you were one of the people that came up with that too. But the challenge I've always had, and actually not just as a change manager also, but it's ultimately, you know, you can try and tell someone that you're only giving them silver service and they should go away. But if they've got the money and they've got the ear of the chief exec and it's something they want to do and it does have an impact on people, you kind of have to listen to them and you have to do it.
Yeah, but I want to put some context in there that we had a small team and we couldn't do everything for everybody.
I don't know. It wasn't just that team. No, I found it actually almost every team I've worked with has tried to take that model. But the reality of doing it is always a bit different.
It is tough. A lot of it comes down, though, to the impact and the benefit that comes from it. So if you go output, outcome, benefit, you know, how much and how much resource you've got to deliver, you know, a portfolio of 30 projects or you know, a number of projects and programs. I do still think you have to have a point which says, well, you're going to get guidance, and that's pretty much all we can get, because over here is this behemoth of a finance change which is supposed to return £2 billion of benefit, and if I'm given my I'm going to attract 5 new customers or £10 billion of benefit, I'm going to get told off if I send you over there, kind of approach. I could be wrong in that thinking, Doug, just to correct me.
I think you're both spot on in both comments. I mean, you know, it's not just a change management thing, it's not just a project management thing, Scrum or product owner or, you know, whatever your role is, we all have to figure out some kind of way to prioritize the responsibilities, the objectives, the KPIs, OKRs, whatever you use. We have to be able to figure out how are we going to prioritize them? What's number one? What's number two? So I think that's a challenge that's not unique just to change management, but everybody faces these days, because there's demand 24/7, 365 for something to be done yesterday. And the second thing is, to your point, I mean, somebody shared something interesting with me the other day that I'd never, like, I kind of knew, but I'd never heard it said. And they said, you know, I'm a project manager. And another person said, you know, I'm a Scrum person, or I'm an Agile fan, or whatever, you know, context they were. And I said, ultimately, what we're trying to do is create change. I was like, yeah, you know, I kind of stopped and thought about that for a minute. And I was like, well, yeah, I guess you do create change in the sense that you're an agent of change, creating some kind of product or output that is available to do something. So you know, we're all in this together in terms of what change is, but the ability to lead change or manage change is different. We're all trying to do the same thing. We're just trying to help each other. That really stood, kind of caught me off guard a little bit. Like, wait a minute, you're an agent of change? I had never thought about
that. I quite like that. So, agent of change sounds cooler than change agent, I think. If we take that.
Yeah, it does. Get a brand team on that.
A couple of bits I wanted to talk about. First was to explain a little bit. We've never talked about the ACMP on this podcast. So I think we have talked about the Change Management Institute. So you're our first mm-hmm. guest mm-hmm. that can kind of give the pitch for what ACMP does. I wonder alongside that as well, whether something we really wanted to get into was to talk a bit about the cultural differences that you might see in the US as well, in terms of how people handle or go through change. Mm-hmm. So take your pick.
CMI and ACMP are almost like one and the same. It's just that CMI is really, they got their focus and their basis and foundation is really in like Australia, Asia Pacific type area. They've also got some other areas in like Europe and things like that, but that's primarily where their core audience of focus is. But ultimately, we're looking to do kind of the same kind of thing almost. ACMP stands for the Association of Change Management Professionals, and it is the equivalent to like what project managers use with PMI, Project Management Institute, or HR people use with SHRM, that kind of thing. It's a professional body dedicated to the profession and the industry to lead the thought leadership, the professionalism, the ethics, the standards, all of that as a place for professionals who are interested or involved in that community. And they want to have a place where they can come for conferences, webinars, continuous learning, professional credentials, things like that. And so that's what ACMP is. It's the global leader in change. They've got chapters in places like in Africa, South Africa, Ukraine, all over North America, Canada, Europe, all over the world, and continues to grow. And to be a part of that was an amazing, humbling, privileged experience that I had. And yeah, just to be able to see change, not just from a North America, Canadian, US perspective, but you know, to see some people out there, like there's so much talent in our community around the world, especially like I never would have thought, but I learned very quickly, Australia has a wealth of talent. And that's, you know, that's where your friends from the last podcast came from, with Flint yep. Studios and everybody, Gilbert yep. and Peter and everybody. Europe, of course, has a wealth of talent as well. I've learned so much from them, but I'm also learning from Africa and how they approach things. And it's so fun and interesting. I think that was so fun and interesting to be able to learn a new perspective, a new cultural dynamic to bring to my toolkit and my tool belt. And it just really helped me to connect with people on a better level. So that's a little bit about what ACMP is.
What's your role in ACMP?
So originally, I got started here in my local state, and we created a chapter for ACMP here in my state. And it's the only one here, still is. And then they annually have like an annual election process where you can be part of the global board of directors. And I thought, okay, I'll throw my hat in the ring, see what happens. I never thought I had a chance. I thought, you know, I'm one in a million. There's probably super talent and superheroes out there that'll get it, right? And I went through the process, and sure enough, they called me one day and, hey, Doug, you know, this is so-and-so, and we want to congratulate you. You've been elected by your global peers to be on the global board. No. And I was like, oh, come on. Who is this? And I hung up. And she called me back, and I was like, no, I'm serious. I'm like, really? Me? You know, it floored me. And it was, so you serve a 3-year commitment on the board. I just finished my third year. And during my second and third year, I also was elected to the treasury role. And now, as I completed my board of directors election, we created something new called the Council of Advisors. And it's brand new. And what we're trying to do is bring together the historical legacy leaders of ACMP and help to create something new where people who are really experienced or tenured in change management can really find value I think there's a lot of growth in the industry right now. A lot of people who are curious about change. My friend calls it the change curious. Dean calls it that. And so there's a lot of them, and there's a lot of people who are new to the profession. And so we're certainly seeing a lot of uptick in those audiences and personas, but we have to make sure that we're continuing to develop and help engage our tenured experienced leaders along the way. And that's what we're hoping to do as we
like a council of elders. I like it.
Yeah.
It's got a Lord of the Rings feel to it. Yeah.
It does sound really good. And the things you'd go to get a new t-shirt and free pen, I'm amazed.
I know. Just think about that. If you walked around, I'm on a council of advisors, the elders or whatever you call it. That would be pretty impressive, wouldn't it?
Yeah, to have that. It's your LinkedIn profile will just explode. It is pretty cool, though, to be fair. And I remember when I was moving in different parts of my career and ending up in change management, looking around, there was not a lot of people to call upon to ask for help. So especially like a collective as well, where you wouldn't just be asking one people, you'd be asking a group that would be able to give you, you know, a variety of opinions to chew over rather than just accepting one route is better than the other. It just didn't exist. It still really in some ways doesn't now. It's where the pod does help is that I know we've connected people that hadn't connected before just through listening to guests and what have you. So you never know where these things lead. But yeah, I think they're a great initiative, that kind of founding council. It's great.
Yeah, I mean, our minds are better when we're together and we combine all that experience. Think about how much we can help the future leaders of change or those big hairy rocks that we're all facing. You know, here's some different perspectives and ideas that we've experienced. Here's some things we learned and that worked.
I agree. I mean, we undertake a set of training through a methodology of choice or whichever one our company inflicts upon us. And that gives us a set of guardrails. I say many times, but actually that gets you so far. And it's the experience and the wounds on your back. They're the ones that tell you sometimes which is the better path to take. And sometimes, you know, it feels like that pathway might be slightly less likely to cause you an injury if there's a group you can go and, you know, pose your questions or thoughts to.
Tell us a bit about the States. What's it like doing change there? But what do you see different elsewhere?
You know, the interesting thing I'll say about ACMP that I really appreciate is that they partner very closely with all the big names in change management. So, you know, the Cotters, the ProSci's, and everybody like that. So, but the thing about the association that I really appreciate is a couple of things. And I don't want to number them, but number one is they're method agnostic. So they don't subscribe to this is the way and follow the checklist or, you know, check the boxes or whatever, right? They do provide a framework called the standard, and it's built around, you know, the best practices, the standards of change management, and it was created by people from all around the world. And as they did it together, and then what they did was they also got it certified through ISO, which is, if you're familiar with ISO, they have a global standard for that. So that's what helps also certify for the testing and the information that you're asked as well, as well as the content. So that's one thing I really loved about it. And that really applies universally because, you know, so many of us, like you said, subscribe to a certain methodology because that's what our companies has chosen or whatever. And so therefore you have to adapt to that one. But being able to understand the fundamentals so that you can go from Cotter to Lewin to ProSci or whatever the different styles are that are out there, I think that's ultimately what I appreciate about that. The other thing I really appreciate about it is the code of ethics. They have a code of ethics that applies to you as a change management professional. And I think in today's world, that stands out a lot to me. Simply, maybe it's a personal choice, but in today's environment, we see a lot of news or articles or, you know, social media posts and things where ethics and decisions and choices and behaviors and actions and things are always in play. And a code of ethics is something that applies to all of us, regardless of what methodology we subscribe to. And I think that I'm getting to your culture question here now. So here it comes. So when you're in Turkey, or whether you're in, let's say, Central or South America, or perhaps the UK, or where have you, knowing that you have those and you have people from all over the world come together to share information that you can, you know, this is my tribe, this is my people. And like you said before, I can ask questions and get answers. I can continuously learn by attending webinars, by presenting and sharing information, or joining their social platform of different information. I think that's how I learned so much about the culture, was because you would see their challenges or where they were. I'll give you a personal experience, and I'm not going to say her name, but she knows who she is, but she's in the Ukraine. And she started a chapter just before the war there. And think about what type of change she's going through, as she's trying to lead change during the last two years.
Yeah.
I think it's been 2 years now
in
Ukraine. And that's totally different than, you know, just the traditional change management that we think of when we think of change management. Because what I came to know was there's a different type of change that people were going through. They were going through, like, you know, almost like Maslow's pyramid. Like, I need the most fundamental thing. How can people help me emotionally? How can people help my family?
What do they do?
It's kind of like coaching, but there's a group of professionals out there who deal with, like, you've gone through some kind of life-changing event or some kind of emergency type of situation, and the trauma, that's the word I'm looking for. Sorry. Trauma coaching. And they often encounter change with people,
focus
on the people, right? But it's not change management like we think, but it's definitely influencing how people go through change. Help me get through this change, and the emotions and the you know, the outcomes of what I've been through. That was an amazing story to watch her go through, but also try and strengthen her people that way, but also any resources we could do to connect and network people with her. It was an amazing experience to be able to watch her go through that, and just how strong of a person she was, and help people lead through change individually, but also professionally as a business and as a chapter, and to really evolve that there. That was, she's amazing. That was one opportunity I had to learn about culture and change.
What do you think makes change? Are there any things you can pick out that are specific to the US, though, or things that we might find a bit different?
I would say in the US, we're probably more microwaveable.
Okay.
If that's a word. I don't know. But like instant, like I got to have it now. And if I have to wait 30 seconds to get my whatever, that's too long. I should have had it like yesterday. And we've gotten so, I don't know, digitalized and so almost immune to the fact that I can do this like that quick. You know, the whole, I'm still amazed by the fax machine personally. I can send a fax and a picture of a fax to somebody anywhere in the world, but we kind of take that for granted, right? And I think here in America, we take a lot of those things for granted. And I think that we're so built up on speed and what's next. And I got to achieve my next goal and objective. And, you know, it's just keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going. And as I watch like other parts of the world, I'm like, why is that country like ranked, quote unquote, the happiest place on earth, or, you know, the country with the most joy or whatever it is that they experience in life? And as I study them, it's a totally different mindset. It's a totally different culture, totally different set of values and perspectives. And it's just, so I think it's a totally different pace culture-wise.
I think we pick up on that in just bits you listen to in media and politics and so on. In that, it's very, especially in the tech space, it's very like, we need to be more like Silicon Valley. We need to be agile. We need to be doing things fast. Yeah. We've got to do it now. So yeah, I can imagine from what you're saying that living in that, I mean, not in Silicon Valley, but in that kind of culture, must be quite jarring from a change perspective, though.
It can be. I actually did work in Silicon Valley, and where I work, we have something, the Silicon Valley slogan or nickname, I guess you could say. It's kind of expanded to different parts of the U.S., but it has its own unique. So like where I live, there's a lot of mountains and skiing, that kind of thing. So there's Silicon Slopes, and there's a lot of technology companies here. And then there's Silicon This and Silicon This in other parts of America too, right? Because Silicon Slopes is beginning to, you know, be distributed and remote and all that kind of stuff as companies go to different places. I just want to go back to that culture thing, because something else that just popped in my head was over the last few years, as I was watching the Prime Minister of New Zealand, watching her go what she went through, and then here in the States, I'm watching our leadership, and I'm like, what bipolar approach is this? You know, and from such different angles, and what's important to the leader, and how they helped their people collectively go through something, or not go through something collectively. I think that's another example that stood out to me as well.
And one of the things I pick up over here, Douglas, is something that's caught my eye over the last couple of years in terms of a cultural thing. And I don't know where it reflects across the world, because actually I haven't asked anybody else, but this obsession with resistance before you've even, you know, formed your plan for change. It's everywhere I go, everyone's like, that's not going to work. You won't be able to do that. You know, they're going to fight you back on that. You have to stand back. You'll have to let them do it themselves. And I'm kind of like, we haven't even really got to the nub of, you know, going right back to the vision of what the change is, let alone what the plan of even using ADCAR would be to build up to remove the resistance. But the obsession with resistance I see over here, particularly through projects I've either worked on or spoken to people about, it seems to be really high in terms of a cultural fear. And I think it is a fear. I think it is somewhat unfounded. I think most employees, if you know, stating the obvious here, but if they understand the reason for the change, they're more likely to accept you. I mean, looking at one of your posts, I love the one where the road splits off and the road wheels off in one direction and the other road is dead straight, but the dead straight road was the one that we've got rid of, you know. But I think that's just fear. It's fear mongering, isn't it, at the very beginning, by people who are, you know, crystallizing myths by telling them that they'll never like it, so then they believe they'll never like it, and then that's it, we're addicted to never liking it, you know. A long way to say the same thing, I guess, but yeah, that's something I know. I don't know whether you find the same over there, because the demand for something quicker means you don't get so much time to have resistance. I don't know. I'm curious.
I have seen a lot more posts on resistance, just the topic in general. And when I see those, I think of a couple things in response. Number one is, why is that? I try to understand. And what I try to do is step away from change management and look at it from a bigger picture. And I think what we're facing today, societally, especially here in the States, is more back to what we said before, a lot of labeling, a lot of stereotyping, a lot of grouping, because as humans, we tend to, you know, for example, you know, somebody might be seeing or watching this podcast and go, oh, well, there's two people with glasses. Obviously, the third one needs glasses or doesn't know about the value of glasses. So probably these people here, you know, that kind of thing. So we see a lot of fractionalism, if that's the right word. A lot of people trying to find their group, but they end up splitting into smaller and smaller entities to try and be with their groups. And I think that's part of the resistance mindset that we're seeing is like, oh, well, that's not us. I'm not in that group. So therefore, you know, it's us versus them or that kind of thing. That's one thing I think that's kind of a catalyst to a lot of the hyperbole around change resistance.
I think we contribute to that sometimes, say, because some part of what we do in, you know, that stakeholder planning or assigning people into group does that.
Yeah, we do. We do, but it's typically based on, like, you know, organizational role, region, the characteristics and the attributes of the company, not so much the demographics of the people. It's more, yeah. I guess you could say. And I do agree with you that sometimes as change leaders, we tend to maybe shoot ourselves in the foot a little bit by using the wrong words, like, you know, change fatigue or change management sometimes is a bit of a oxymoron. You know, there's lots of words that, you know, change fails 70% of the time is something we often read, even though it's not a true factor. So, you know, those kinds of things that we're saying about ourselves can also hurt us as well. I think we need to evaluate our own language, our own mindsets and thinking as we lead change, and think about, am I reflecting what I'm preaching? Am I teaching, you know, doing what I'm preaching?
Yeah.
Walking the walk. The second thing that comes to my mind is, like, when I see all those articles on resistance, it's always about, you got to overcome it. You got to beat it. You got to win it. And it's like us versus them. And I don't think that's what it should be. I think it should be understand it. Because if you don't understand that resistance, then you don't truly fully understand the change as well as you should.
Spot on. Absolutely agree.
If you are trying to overcome resistance, that means you're trying to win. So you're right, they're wrong. You win, they lose. And that's not what we should be doing.
I say this on other things, Douglas, we say about taking therapy at the very beginning of a change to understand what it is, to help listen to the fears right up front. Because if you've got that right up front, you don't need to worry about the resistance because you'll build your change plan around what their fears are early on, right?
Yeah, yeah. And oftentimes as change managers, we do wear therapy hats. So there's lots of things we do, right? But I think it's about understanding it, embracing it. And if you do that, then you're building the trust and you're gaining the voice, you're hearing the voice and you're gaining their confidence rather than coming to the table at the end and they're like, hey, wait a minute, or, I don't know anything about this, or, disrupting your whole effort that you put in, the time and the money and the budget and the sweat and the tears and the blood. And you got to embrace it. Don't look at it as like, Darth Vader versus Luke Skywalker, kind of thing.
That's the soundbite, Pete.
I was thinking of something a bit more. You probably won't know who the Borg are or what Doctor Who is, or perhaps that's too British. I don't know. Okay. Yeah. No, it's that assimilation mindset of the Borg. Maybe that's more where we need to go.
Yeah. Maybe that resonates more. Or,
there's one last question we like to finish on, which is apparently quite a cultural distinguisher we found last week with the Aussies, and it's quite mundane, I think, but it's just, what if you could tell us what your favorite biscuit is?
And we don't mean potatoes and gravy. I learned this the other day. Yeah, cookies. Yeah, I learned the other day biscuits can be like a potato covered in gravy, can't it?
That's an American thing, biscuits and gravy. I wasn't even gonna respond with that. That's a totally different thing. I just thought of what my favorite biscuit is. Okay, so this was when I was a little child. My grandmother would make this cookie, and it was basically, it was kind of like peanut. It was dough, but it had some peanut butter flavor to it a little bit, and a little bit of sugar on top. And then you'd warm it up, and then in the middle, you'd put like a Hershey Kiss.
Oh, nice. Yes.
Have you heard of those?
Yep.
And they were called Kisses. I don't know. But when they were warm, they would just go in your mouth and they would just like melt, and they were so good, that combination of peanut butter and chocolate, of course, and just a hint of a little bit of sugar on top. That's probably my favorite cookie because of my childhood
experiences. That sounds way better than anything we've talked about.
It's been super great having you, and I know we'll do this again. I've got a great idea about the next one actually involving you, Doug, so we'll talk offline about that. But thank you so much for joining us.
Great to meet you as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.